This is The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. This is the second of two parts of Chapter 4, entitled The Cruel Hand. The Silent Minority. If shackling former prisoners with a lifetime of debt and authorizing discrimination against them in employment, housing, education, and public benefits is not enough to send the message that they are not wanted and not even considered full citizens, then stripping voting rights from those labeled criminals surely gets the point across. 48 states in the District of Columbia prohibit inmates from voting while incarcerated for a felony offense. Only 2 states, Maine and Vermont, permit inmates to vote. The vast majority of states continue to withhold the right to vote when prisoners are released on parole. Even after the term of punishment expires, some states deny the right to vote for a period ranging from a number of years to the rest of one's life. This is far from the norm in other countries, like Germany, for instance, which allows and even encourages prisoners to vote. In fact, about half of European countries allow all incarcerated people to vote, while others disqualify only a small number of prisoners from the polls. Prisoners vote either in their correctional facilities or by some version of absentee ballot in their town of previous residence. Almost all of the countries that place some restrictions on voting in prison are in Eastern Europe, part of the former communist bloc. No other country in the world disenfranchises people who are released from prison in a manner even remotely resembling the United States. In fact, the United Nations Human Rights Committee has charged that the U.S. disenfranchisement policies are discriminatory and violate international law. In those few European countries that permit limited post-prison disqualification, the sanction is very narrowly tailored, and the number of people disenfranchised is probably in the dozens or hundreds. In the United States, by contrast, voting disqualification upon release from prison is automatic, with no legitimate purpose, and affects millions. Even those former prisoners who are technically eligible to vote frequently remain disenfranchised for life. Every state has developed its own process for restoring voters' rights to ex-offenders. Typically, the restoration process is a bureaucratic maze that requires the payment of fines or court costs. The process is so cumbersome, confusing, and onerous that many ex-offenders who are theoretically eligible to vote never manage to get their voting rights back. Throughout much of the United States, ex-offenders are expected to pay fines and court costs and submit paperwork to multiple agencies in an effort to win back the right that should never have been taken away in a democracy. These bureaucratic minefields are the modern-day equivalent of poll taxes and literacy tests, colorblind rules designed to make voting a practical impossibility for a group defined largely by race. The message communicated by felon disenfranchisement laws, policies, and bureaucratic procedures is not lost on those such as Clinton Drake, who are effectively barred from voting for life. Drake, a 55-year-old African-American man in Montgomery, Alabama, was arrested in 1988 for possession of marijuana. 5 years later, he was arrested again, this time for having about $10 worth of the drug on him. Facing between 10 and 20 years in prison as a repeat offender, Drake, a Vietnam veteran and, at the time, a cook on a local Air Force base, took his public defender's advice and accepted a plea bargain. Under the plea agreement, he would only have to spend 5 years behind bars. 5 years for 5 joints. Once released, Drake found he was forbidden by law from voting until he paid his $900 in court costs, an impossible task given that he was unemployed and the low-wage jobs he might conceivably find would never allow him to accumulate hundreds of dollars in savings. For all practical purposes, he would never be able to vote again. Shortly before the 2000 presidential election, he said in despair, "I put my life on the line for this country. To me, not voting is not right. It led to a lot of frustration, a lot of anger. My son's in Iraq, in the army, just like I was. My oldest son, he fought in the first Persian Gulf conflict. He was in the Marines. This is my baby son over there right now, but I'm not able to vote. They say I owe $900 in fines. To me, that's a poll tax. You gotta pay to vote. It's a restitution, they say. I came off parole in October 13, 1999, but I'm still not allowed to vote. Last time I voted was in 88. Bush versus Dukakis. Bush won. I voted for Dukakis. If it was up to me, I'd vote his son out this time, too. I know a lot of friends got the same cases like I got, not able to vote. A lot of guys doing the same things like I was doing. Just marijuana. They treat marijuana in Alabama like you committed treason or something. I was on the 1965 Voting Rights March in Selma. I was 15 years old. At 18, I was in Vietnam, fighting for my country. And now? Unemployed, and they won't allow me to vote." Drake's vote, along with the votes of millions of other ex-felons, would have made a difference in the 2000 presidential election. Following the election, It was widely reported that, had the 600,000 former felons who had completed their sentence in Florida been allowed to vote, Al Gore would have been elected president of the United States rather than George W. Bush. 4 years later, voter registration workers in the South encountered scores of ex-offenders who were reluctant to register to vote, even if they were technically eligible, because they were scared to have any contact with governmental authorities. Many on welfare were worried that any little thing they did to bring attention to themselves might put their food stamps at risk. Others had been told by parole and probation officers that they could not vote, and although this was not true, they believed it, and the news spread like wildfire. How long you think it take if someone tells you you can't vote before it spreads? Asked one ex-offender. It's been years and years, people telling you you can't vote. You live in a slum. You're not counted. Even those who knew they were eligible to register worried that registering to vote would somehow attract attention to them, perhaps land them back in jail. While this might strike some as paranoia, many Southern blacks have vivid memories of the harsh consequences that befell their parents and grandparents who attempted to vote in defiance of poll taxes, literacy tests, and other devices adopted to suppress the black vote. Many were terrorized by the Klan. Today, ex-offenders live in constant fear of a different form of racial repression, racial profiling, police brutality, and revocation of parole. One investigative journalist described the situation this way. Overwhelmingly, black people in Mississippi are scared of any form of contact with authorities they saw as looking for excuses to reincarcerate them. In neighborhood after neighborhood, the grandchildren of civil rights pioneers from the 1950s were as scared to vote because of prisons and the threat of prisons as their grandparents were a half a century ago because of the threat of the lynch mob. Nishambi Lamright of the Jackson ACLU concurs. People aren't even trying to get their vote back, he said. It's hard to just getting them to attempt to register. They're terrorized. They're so scared of going back to jail that they won't even try it. Research indicates that a large number of close elections would have come out differently if felons had been allowed to vote, including at least 7 senatorial races between 1980 and 2000. The impact on those major elections undoubtedly would be greater if all those deterred or prevented from voting were taken into account. But as ex-offenders will hasten to emphasize, it's not just the big elections that matter. One ex-offender put it this way. I have no right to vote on the school referendums that will affect my children. I have no right to vote on how my taxes is going to be spent or used, which I have to pay whether I'm a felon or not, you know? So basically, I've lost all voice or control over my government. I get mad because I can't say anything because I don't have a voice. Those who do have their voting rights restored often describe a feeling of validation, even pride. I got a voice now, said Willa Womack, a 44-year-old African-American woman who had been incarcerated on drug charges. I can decide now who will be my governor, who will be my president. I have a vote now. I feel like somebody. It's a feeling of relief from where I came from, that I'm actually somebody. The pariahs. For Americans who are not caught up in this system of control, it can be difficult to imagine what life would be like if discrimination against you were perfectly legal, if you were not allowed to participate in the political system, and if you were not eligible for food stamps or welfare that could be denied housing assistance. Yet, as bad as these forms of discrimination are, many ex-offenders will tell you that the formal mechanisms of exclusion are not the worst of it. The shame and stigma that follows you for the rest of your life, that is the worst. It's not just the job denial, but the look that flashes across the face of a potential employer when he notices that the box has been checked, the way he suddenly refuses to look you in the eye. It's not merely the denial of housing application, but the shame of being a grown man who has to beg his grandmother for a place to sleep at night. It's not simply the denial of the right to vote, but the shame one feels when a coworker innocently asks, "Who are you going to vote for on Tuesday?" One need not be formally convicted in a court of law to be subject to this shame and stigma. As long as you look like or seem like a criminal, you are treated with the same suspicion and contempt, not just by police, security guards, or hall monitors at your school, but also by the woman who crosses the street to avoid you, and by the store employees who follow you through the aisles, eager to catch you in the act of being the criminal black man, the archetypal figure who justifies the new Jim Crow. Practically from cradle to grave, black males in urban ghettos are treated like current or future criminals. One may learn to cope with this stigma of criminality, but like the stigma of race, the prison label is not something that a black man in the ghetto can ever fully escape. For those newly released from prison, the pain is particularly acute. As Dorsey Nunn, an ex-offender and co-founder of All of Us or None, once put it, "The biggest hurdle you gotta get over when you walk out those prison gates is the shame. That shame, that stigma, that label, that thing you wear around your neck saying I'm a criminal. It's like a yoke around your neck, and it'll drag you down, even kill you if you let it. Many ex-offenders experience an existential angst associated with their permanent social exclusion. Henry, a young African-American convicted of a felony, explains, "It's like you broke the law, you bad. You broke the law, bang. You're not part of us anymore." That sentiment is shared by a woman, currently incarcerated, who described the experience this way. "When I leave here, it will be very difficult for me in the sense that I'm a felon, that I always will be a felon. For me to leave here, it will affect my job, it'll affect my education, custody of my children. It can affect child support, it can affect everywhere, family, friends, housing. People that are convicted of drug crimes can't even get housing anymore. Yes, I did my prison time. How long are you going to punish me as a result of it? And not only on paper, I'm only on paper for 10 months when I leave here, that's all the parole I have. But that parole isn't going to be anything. It's the housing, it's the credit reestablishing. I mean, even to go to the school, to work with my child's class. I'm not a sex offender, but all I need is one parent who says, 'Isn't she a felon? I don't want her with my child.'" The permanence of one's social exile is often the hardest to swallow. For many, it seems inconceivable that, for a minor offense, you can be subject to discrimination, scorn, and exclusion for the rest of your life. Human Rights Watch, in its report documenting the experiences of America's undercast, tells the story of a 57-year-old African-American woman denied rental housing by a federally funded landlord due to a minor conviction she did not even know was on her record. After being refused reconsideration, she asked her caseworker in pained exasperation, "Am I going to be a criminal for the rest of my life?" When someone is convicted of a crime today, their debt to society is never paid. The cruel hand that Frederick Douglass spoke of more than 150 years ago has appeared once again. In this new system of control, like the last, many black men hold up their heads, if at all, against the withering influence of a nation's scorn and contempt. Willie Johnson, a 43-year-old African-American man recently released from prison in Ohio, explained it this way. "My felony conviction has been like a mental punishment because of all the obstacles. Every time I go to put in a job application, I've had three companies hire me and tell me to come to work the next day, but then the day before, they'll call you and tell you don't come in because you have a felony. And that's what's devastating, because you think you're about to go to work and they call you and say, because of your felony, we can't hire you. I've run into this at least a dozen times. Two times I got very depressed and sad because I couldn't take care of myself as a man. It was like I wanted to give up, because in society nobody wants to give us a helping hand. Right now I'm considered homeless. I've never been homeless until I left the penitentiary, and now I know what it feels like to be homeless. If it was not for my family, I would be in the streets, sleeping in the cold. We black men have three strikes against us. One because we're black, and two because we're a black male, and the final strike is a felony. These are the greatest three strikes that a black man has against him in this country. I have friends who don't have a felony and have a hard time getting a job. But if a black man can't find a job to take care of himself, he's ashamed he can't take care of his children." Not surprisingly, for many black men, the hurt and depression gives way to anger. A black minister in Waterloo, Mississippi, explained his outrage at the fate that has befallen African Americans in the post-civil rights era. "It's a hustle," he said angrily. "Felony is the new N-word. They don't have to call you a nigger anymore. They just say you're a felon. In every ghetto, you see alarming numbers of young men with felony convictions. Once you have a felony stamp, your hope for employment, for any kind of integration into society, it begins to fade out. Today's lynching is a felony charge. Today's lynching is incarceration. Today's lynch mobs are professionals. They have a badge. They have a law degree. A felony is a modern way of saying, I'm going to hang you up and burn you. Once you get that F, you're on fire." Remarkably, it is not uncommon today to hear media pundits, politicians, social critics, and celebrities, most notably Bill Cosby, complain that the biggest problem black men have today is that they have no shame. Many worry that prison time has become a badge of honor in some communities. A rite of passage is the term often used in the press. Others claim that inner-city residents no longer share the same value system as mainstream society, and therefore are not stigmatized by criminality. Yet, as Donald Braman, author of Doing Time on the Outside, states, one can only assume that most participants in these discussions have had little direct contact with the families and communities they're discussing. Over a 4-year period, Braman conducted a major ethnographic study of families affected by mass incarceration in Washington, D.C., a city where 3 out of every 4 young black men can expect to spend some time behind bars. He found that, contrary to popular belief, Young men labeled criminals and their families are profoundly hurt and stigmatized by their status. They're not shameless. They feel the stigma that accompanies not only incarceration, but all other stereotypes that accompany it. Fatherlessness, poverty, and often, despite every intent to make it otherwise, diminished love. The results of Bramman's study have been largely corroborated by similar studies elsewhere in the United States. These studies indicate that the biggest problem the black community may face today is not the shamelessness, but rather the severe isolation, distrust, and alienation created by mass incarceration. During Jim Crow, blacks were severely stigmatized and segregated on the basis of race, but in their own communities they could find support, solidarity, acceptance, love. Today, when those labeled criminals return to their communities, they're often met with scorn and contempt, not just by employers, welfare workers, and housing officials, but also by their own neighborhoods, teachers, and even members of their own families. This is so even when they've been imprisoned for minor drug offenses, such as possession and sale of a small amount of drugs. Young black males in their teens are often told, "You'll amount to nothing," or "You'll find yourself back in jail just like your father," a not-so-subtle suggestion that a shameful defect lies deep within them, an inherited trait, perhaps, part of their genetic makeup. "You're a criminal, nothing but a criminal. You are a no-good criminal." The anger and frustration directed at black men returning home from prison is understandable, given that they are returning to communities that are hurt by joblessness and crime. These communities desperately need their young men to be holding down jobs and supporting their families, rather than wasting away in prison cells. While there's widespread recognition that the war on drugs is racist and that politicians have refused to invest in jobs or schools in their communities, parents of offenders and ex-offenders still feel intense shame. Shame that their children have turned to crime despite a lack of obvious alternatives. One mother of an incarcerated teen, Constance, described her angst this way. "Regardless of what you feel like you've done for your child, it still comes back on you, and you feel like, well, maybe I did something wrong, maybe I messed up, you know, maybe if I had did it this way, then it wouldn't have happened that way." After her son's arrest, she could not bring herself to tell friends and relatives, and kept the family's suffering private. Constance is not alone. Eerie silence. David Bramman's ethnographic research shows that mass incarceration, far from reducing the stigma associated with criminality, actually creates a deep silence in communities of color, one rooted in shame. Imprisonment is considered so shameful that many people avoid talking about it, even within their own families. Some, like Constance, are silent because they blame themselves for their children's fate and believe that others blame them as well. Others are silent because they believe hiding the truth will protect friends and family members, e.g., "I don't know what his incarceration would do to his aunt. She thinks so highly of him." Others claim that a loved one's criminality is a private family matter. Somebody's business is nobody's business. Remarkably, even in communities devastated by mass incarceration, many people struggling to cope with the stigma of imprisonment have no idea that their neighbors are struggling with the same grief, shame, and isolation. Bramman reported that, "When I asked participants in the study if they knew of other people in the neighborhood, many did not know of one or two out of the dozens of households on the block that had members incarcerated, but did not feel comfortable talking with others." This type of phenomenon has been described in the psychological literature as pluralistic ignorance, in which people misjudge the norm. One example is found in studies of college freshmen who overestimate the drinking among other freshmen. When it comes to families of prisoners, however, their underestimation of the extent of incarceration in their communities exacerbates their sense of isolation, by making the imprisonment of their family members seem more abnormal than it is. Even in church, a place where many people seek solace in times of grief and sorrow, families of prisoners often keep the secret of imprisonment of their children or relatives. As one woman responded when asked if she could turn to church members for support, "Church, I wouldn't dare tell anyone at church." Far from being a place of comfort or refuge, churches can be a place where judgment, shame, and contempt are felt most acutely. Services in black churches frequently contain a strong mixture of concern for the less fortunate and a call to personal responsibility. As Kathy Cohen has observed, ministers and members of black congregations have helped to develop what she calls the indigenous-constructed image of good black Christian folk. Black churches, in this cultural narrative, are places where the good black people in the community can be found. To the extent that the imprisonment of one's son or relative or one's own imprisonment is experienced as a personal failure, a failure of personal responsibility, church can be a source of fresh pain rather than comfort. Those who have had positive experiences of acceptance and sympathy after disclosing the status of a loved one, or their own status, report that they are better able to cope. Notably, however, even after such positive experiences, most family members remain committed to maintaining tight control over who knows and who does not know about the status of their loved one. According to Braman, not one of the family members in his study had come out completely to their extended families at church and at work. Passing redux. Lying about incarcerated family members is another common coping strategy, a form of passing. Whereas light-skinned blacks during the Jim Crow era sometimes cut off relations with friends and families in an effort to pass as white and enjoy the upward mobility and privilege associated with whiteness, today many family members of prisoners lie and try to hide the status of their relatives in an effort to mitigate the stigma of criminality. This is especially the case at work, employment settings where family members interact with people they believe could not possibly understand what they're going through. One woman, Ruth, whose younger brother is incarcerated, says she would never discuss her brother with co-workers or supervisors, though they have long shared information about their personal lives. You know, I talked to my supervisor about stuff, but not this. This was too much, and it definitely made, well, it was just harder to talk to him. He wants to know how my brother is. I just can't tell it to him. What does he know about prison? When asked to explain why her white co-workers and supervisors would have trouble understanding her brother's incarceration, Ruth explained that it was not just incarceration, but everything. Everything related to race. As an example, she mentioned the nights when she works late. I tell my boss all the time. I say, if you want me to take a taxi, you go down there and flag one for me. I'm not getting out there and stand 20 minutes for a cab when they'll run me over to get to you. He's white, and see, he don't know the difference because he's from Seattle, Washington. He looks at me real strange, like, what are you talking about? Many ex-offenders and families of prisoners are desperately attempting to be perceived as part of the modern upwardly mobile class, even if their income does not place them in it. Ex-offenders lie by refusing to check the box on employment applications, and family members lie through omission or obfuscation because they're painfully aware of the historically intransigent stereotypes of criminal, dysfunctional families that pervade not only public discussions of inner cities, but of the black community in general. This awareness can lead beyond shame to a place of self-hate. One mother of an incarcerated teenager described the self-hate she perceives in the black community this way. All your life you've been taught that you're not a worthy person or something is wrong with you, so you don't have no respect for yourself. See, people of color have, not all of them, but a lot of them, have poor self-esteem because we've been branded. We hate ourselves, you know? We've been programmed that it's something that's wrong with us. We hate ourselves. This self-hate, she explained, does not affect just the young boys who find themselves getting in trouble and fulfilling the negative expectations of those in the community and beyond. Self-hate is also a part of the reason people in her neighborhood do not speak to each other about the impact of incarceration on their families and their lives. In her nearly all-black neighborhood, she worries about what neighbors would think about her if she revealed that her son had been labeled a criminal. It's hard because, like I say, we've been labeled all our lives that we're the bad people. The silence this stigma engenders among family members, neighbors, friends, relatives, co-workers, and strangers is perhaps the most painful, yet least acknowledged, aspect of the new system of control. The historical anthropologist Gerald Sider once wrote, "We can have no significant understanding of any culture unless we also know the silences that were institutionally created and guaranteed along with it." Nowhere is that observation more relevant in American society today than in an analysis of the culture of mass incarceration. Descriptions of the silence that hovers over mass incarceration are rare because people, whether they're social scientists, judges, politicians, or reporters, are usually more interested in speech, acts, and events than in the negative field of silence and estrangement that lurks beneath the surface. But, as Braman rightly notes, those who live in the shadows of this silence are devalued as human beings. There is a repression of self experienced by these families in their silence. The retreat of a mother or wife from friendships in church and at work, the words not spoken between friends, the enduring silence of children who guard what for them is profound and powerful information, are all telling indicators of the social effects of incarceration. As relationships between family and friends become strained or false, not only are people's understandings of one another diminished, but because people are social, they themselves are diminished as well. The harm done by this social silence is more than interpersonal. The silence, driven by stigma and fear of shame, results in a repression of public thought, a collective denial of lived experience. As Braman puts it, By forcing out of the public view the struggles that these families face in the most simple and fundamental acts, living together and caring for one another, this broader social silence makes it seem as though ghetto families simply are that way, broken, valueless, irreparable. It also makes community healing and collective political action next to impossible. Gangsta love. For some, the notion that black communities are severely stigmatized and shamed by criminality is counterintuitive. If incarceration in many urban areas is the statistical norm, why isn't it socially normative as well? It's true that imprisonment has become normal in ghetto communities. In major cities across the United States, the majority of young black men are under the control of the criminal justice system or saddled with criminal records. But just because the prison label has become normal does not mean that it is generally viewed as acceptable. Poor people of color, like other Americans, indeed like nearly everyone around the world, want safe streets, peaceful communities, healthy families, good jobs, and meaningful opportunities to contribute to society. The notion that ghetto families do not in fact want those things and instead are perfectly content to live in crime-ridden communities, feeling no shame or regret about the fate of their young men, is quite simply racist. It is impossible to imagine that we would believe such a thing about whites. The predictable response is, what about gangsta rap and the culture of violence that has been embraced by so many black youth? Is there not some truth to the notion that black culture has devolved in recent years, as reflected in youth standing on the street corners with pants sagging below their rears and rappers boasting about beating their hoes and going to jail? Is there not some reason to wonder whether the black community to some extent has lost its moral compass? The easy answer is to say yes and wag a finger at those who are behaving badly. That is the road most traveled, and it has not made a bit of difference. The media fawn over Bill Cosby and other figures when they give stern lectures to black audiences about black men failing to be good fathers and failing to lead respectable lives. They act as though this is a message black audiences have not heard many times before from their ministers, from their family members, and from politicians who talk about the need for more personal responsibility. Many seem genuinely surprised that blacks in the audience applaud these messages. For them, it is apparently news that black people think men should be good fathers and help to support their families. The more difficult answer, the more courageous one, is to say yes, we should be concerned about the behavior of men trapped in ghetto communities, but the deep failure of morality is our own. Economist Glenn Lowry once posed the question, are we willing to cast ourselves as a society that creates criminogenic conditions for some of its members and then acts out rituals of punishment against them as if engaged in some awful form of human sacrifice? A similar question can be posed with respect to shaming those trapped in ghettos. Are we willing to demonize a population, declare war against them, and then stand back and heap shame and contempt upon them for failing to behave like model citizens while under attack? In this regard, it is helpful to step back and put the behavior of young black men who appear to embrace gangsta culture in the proper perspective. There's absolutely nothing abnormal or surprising about a severely stigmatized group embracing their stigma. Psychologists have long observed that when people feel hopelessly stigmatized, a powerful coping strategy, often the only apparent route to self-esteem, is embracing one's stigmatized identity, hence black is beautiful and gay pride slogans and anthems of political movements aimed at ending not only legal discrimination, but the stigma that justified it. Indeed, the act of embracing one's stigma is never merely psychological maneuver. It's a political act, an act of resistance and defiance in a society that seeks to demean a group based on an inalterable trait. As a gay activist once put it, only by fully embracing the stigma itself can one neutralize the sting and make it laughable. For those black youth who are constantly followed by police and shamed by teachers, relatives, and strangers, embracing the stigma of criminality is an act of rebellion, an attempt to carve out a positive identity in a society that offers them little more than scorn, contempt, and constant surveillance. Ronnie, a 16-year-old African-American on probation for a drug-related offense, explains it this way. My grandma keeps asking me about when I'm going to get arrested again. She thinks just because I went in before, I'll go in again. At my school, my teachers talk about calling the cops again to take me away. The cop keeps checking up on me. He's always at the park making sure I don't get into trouble again. My PO, probation officer, is always knocking on my door talking shit to me, even at the BYA, the local youth development organization. The staff treat me like I'm a fuck-up. Shit don't change. It doesn't matter where I go. I'm seen as a criminal. I just say, if you're going to treat me as a criminal, then I'm going to treat you like I am one. You feel me? I'm going to make you shake so that you can say that there's a reason for calling me a criminal. I grew up knowing that I had to show these fools, adults who criminalize the youth, that I wasn't going to take their shit. I started to act like a thug, even if I wasn't one. Part of it was me trying to be hard. The other part was them treating me like I'm a criminal. The problem, of course, is that embracing criminality, while a natural response to the stigma, is inherently self-defeating and destructive. While Black is Beautiful is a powerful antidote to the logic of Jim Crow, and Gay Pride is a liberating motto for those challenging homophobia, the natural corollary for young men trapped in the ghetto in an era of mass incarceration is something akin to gangsta love. While race and sexual orientation are perfectly appropriate aspects of one identity to embrace, criminality for its own sake most certainly is not. The war on drugs has greatly exacerbated the problems associated with drug abuse, rather than solved them, but the fact remains that the violence associated with the illegal drug trade is nothing to be celebrated. Black crime cripples the Black community and does no favors to the individual offender. So herein lies the paradox and predicament of young Black men labeled criminals. A war has been declared on them. They have been rounded up for engaging in precisely the same crimes that go largely ignored in middle and upper class white communities, possession and sale of illegal drugs. For those residing in ghetto communities, employment is scarce, often non-existent. Schools located in ghetto communities more closely resemble prisons than places of learning, creativity, or moral development. And because the drug war has been raging for decades now, the parents of children coming of age today were targets of the drug war as well. As a result, many fathers are in prison, and those who are free bear the prison label. They're often unable to provide for or meaningfully contribute to a family. Any wonder, then, that many youth embrace their stigmatized identity as means of survival in this new caste system? Should we be shocked when they turn to gangs or fellow inmates for support when no viable family support structure exists? After all, in many respects, they're simply doing what Black people did during the Jim Crow era. They're turning to each other for support and solace in a society that despises them. Yet, when these young people do what all severely stigmatized groups do, try to cope by turning to each other and embracing their stigma in a desperate effort to regain some measure of self-esteem, we as a society heap more shame and contempt upon them. We tell them their friends are no good, that they will amount to nothing, that they're wasting their lives, and that they're nothing but criminals. We condemn their baggy pants, a fashion trend that mimics prison-issue pants, and the music that glorifies a life many feel they cannot avoid. When we're done shaming them, we throw up our hands and then turn our backs as they're carted off to jail. The Minstrel Show. None of the foregoing should be interpreted as an excuse for the violence, decadence, or misogyny that pervades what has come to be known as gangsta culture. The images and messages are extremely damaging. On an average night, one need engage in only a few minutes of channel surfing during primetime hours to stumble across images of gangsta culture on television. The images are so familiar, no description is necessary here. Often these images emanate from BET or Black-themed reality shows, and thus are considered authentic expressions of Black attitudes, culture, and mores. Again, though, it's useful to put the commodification of gangsta culture in its proper perspective. The worst of gangsta rap and other forms of Blaxploitation, such as VH1's Flavor of Love, is best understood as a modern-day minstrel show, only this time televised around the clock for a worldwide audience. It is a for-profit display of the worst racial stereotypes and images associated with the era of mass incarceration, an era in which Black people are criminalized and portrayed as out of control, shameless, violent, oversexed, and generally undeserving. Like the minstrel shows of the slavery and Jim Crow eras, today's displays are generally designed for white audiences. The majority of consumers of gangsta rap are white, suburban teenagers. VH1 had its best ratings ever for the first season of Flavor of Love, ratings driven by large white audiences. MTV has expanded its offerings of Black-themed reality shows in the hopes of attracting the same crowd. The profits to be made from racial stigma are considerable, and the fact that Blacks as well as whites treat racial oppression as a commodity for consumption is not surprising. It's a familiar form of Black complicity with racialized systems of control. Many people are unaware that, although minstrel shows were plainly designed to pander to white racism and to make whites feel comfortable with, indeed entertained by, racial oppression, African Americans formed a large part of the Black minstrels' audience. In fact, their numbers were so great in some areas that theater owners had to relax rules segregating Black patrons and restricting them to certain areas of the theater. Historians have long debated why blacks would attend minstrel shows when the images and content were so blatantly racist. Minstrels projected a greatly romanticized and exaggerated image of black life on plantations, with cheerful, simple, grinning slaves, always ready to sing, dance, and please their masters. Some have suggested that perhaps blacks felt in on the joke, laughing at the over-the-top characters from a sense of in-group recognition. It has also been argued that perhaps they felt some connection to elements of African culture that had been suppressed and condemned for so long, but were suddenly visible on stage, albeit in racist, exaggerated form. Undeniably, though, one major draw for black audiences was simply seeing fellow African Americans on stage. Black minstrels were largely viewed as celebrities, earning more money and achieving more fame than African Americans ever had before. Black minstrelsy was the first large-scale opportunity for African Americans to enter show business. To some degree, then, black minstrelsy, as degrading as it was, represented success. It seems likely that historians will one day look back on the images of black men in gangsta rap videos with a similar curiosity. Why would these young men, who were targets of a brutal drug war declared against them, put on a show, a spectacle, that romanticizes and glorifies their criminalization? Why would these young men openly endorse and perpetuate the very stereotypes that are invoked to justify their second-class status, their exclusion from mainstream society? The answers, historians may find, are not that different from the answers of the minstrelsy puzzle. It's important to keep in mind, though, that many hip-hop artists today do not embrace and perpetuate the worst racial stereotypes associated with mass incarcerations. Artists like Common, for example, articulate a sharp critique of American politics and culture and reject the misogyny and violence preached by gangsta rappers. And while rap is often associated with gangsta life in the mainstream press, the origins of rap and hip-hop culture are not rooted in outlaw ideology. When rap was born, the early rap stars were not rapping about gangsta life, but My Adidas and Good Times in the Hood in tunes like Rapper's Delight. Rap music changed when the war on drugs shifted into high gear and thousands of young black men were suddenly swept off the streets and into prisons. Violence in urban communities flared in those communities, not simply because of the new drug, crack, but because of the massive crackdown, which radically reshaped the traditional life course for young black men. As a tidal wave of punitiveness, stigma, and despair washed over poor communities of color, those who were demonized, not only in the mainstream press, but often in their own communities, did what all stigmatized groups do. They struggled to preserve a positive identity by embracing their stigma. Gangsta rap, while it may amount to little more than a minstrel show when it appears on MTV today, has its roots in the struggle for a positive identity among outcasts. The antidote. It is difficult to look at pictures of black people performing in minstrel shows during the Jim Crow era. It's almost beyond belief that at one time black people actually covered their faces with pitch black paint, covered their mouths with white paint drawn in an exaggerated clownish smile, and pranced on stage for the entertainment and delight of white audiences, who were tickled by the sight of a black man happily portraying the worst racial stereotypes that justified slavery and later Jim Crow. The images are so painful, they can cause a downright visceral reaction. The damage done by the minstrel's complicity in the Jim Crow regime was considerable. Even so, do we hate the minstrel? Do we despise him? Or do we understand him as an unfortunate expression of the times? Most people of any race would probably condemn the minstrel show, but stop short of condemning the minstrel as a man. Pity more than contempt seems the likely response. Why? With the benefit of hindsight, we can see the minstrel in his social context. By shucking and jiving for white audiences, he was mirroring to white audiences the shame and contempt projected onto him. He might have made a decent living that way, may even have been treated as a celebrity, but from a distance we can see the emptiness, the pain. When the system of mass incarceration collapses, and if history is any guide it will, historians will undoubtedly look back and marvel that such an extraordinary comprehensive system of racialized control existed in the United States. How fascinating, they will likely say, that a drug war was waged almost exclusively against poor people of color, people already trapped in ghettos that lacked jobs and decent schools. They were rounded up by the millions, packed away in prisons, and when released, they were stigmatized for life, denied the right to vote, and ushered into a world of discrimination. Legally barred from employment, housing, and welfare benefits, and saddled with thousands of dollars of debt, these people were shamed and condemned for failing to hold together their families. They were chastised for succumbing to depression and anger, and blamed for landing back in prison. Historians will likely wonder how we could describe the new caste system as a system of crime control when it is difficult to imagine a system better designed to create rather than prevent crime. None of this is to suggest that those who break the law bear no responsibility for their conduct or exist merely as products of their environment. To deny the individual agency of those caught up in the system, their capacity to overcome seemingly impossible odds, would be to deny an essential element of their humanity. We as human beings are not simply organisms or animals responding to stimuli. We have a higher self, a capacity for transcendence. Yet our ability to exercise free will and transcend the most extraordinary obstacles does not make the conditions of our life irrelevant. Most of us struggle and often fail to meet the biggest challenges of our lives. Even the smaller challenges, breaking a bad habit or sticking to a diet, often prove too difficult, even for those of us who are relatively privileged and comfortable in our daily lives. In fact, what is most remarkable about the hundreds of thousands of people who return from prison to their communities each year is not how many fail, but how many somehow manage to survive and stay out of prison against all the odds. Considering the design of this new system of control, it is astonishing that so many people labeled criminals still manage to care for and feed their children, hold together marriages, obtain employment, and start businesses. Perhaps most heroic are those who, upon release, launch social justice organizations that challenge the discrimination ex-offenders face and provide desperately needed support for those newly released from prison. These heroes go largely unnoticed by politicians who prefer to blame those who fail rather than praise with admiration and awe all those who somehow manage, despite seemingly insurmountable hurdles, to survive. As a society, our decision to heap shame and contempt upon those who struggle and fail in a system designed to keep them locked up and locked out says far more about ourselves than it does about them. There is another path. Rather than shaming and condemning an already deeply stigmatized group, we collectively can embrace them. Not necessarily their behavior, but them, their humanness. As the saying goes, you gotta hate the crime, but love the criminal. This is not a mere platitude. It's a prescription for liberation. If we had actually learned to show love, care, compassion, and concern across racial lines during the civil rights movement, rather than go colorblind, mass incarceration would not exist today.